Good morning, everyone. So as Heino said, I want to take you to the other end of the spectrum here, so longer wavelengths than what we're going after with the EHT. But going back to Jonathan McKinney's talk, really about setting the boundary conditions for the problem of extracting physics from the EHT observations. And there are really two domains where that's important. And one is the intrinsic size or the intrinsic properties of Sagittarius A star. And the other domain is characterizing this interstellar scattering that's along the line of sight and which has created so many problems, but so many interesting intellectual puzzles along the way. So in this talk, I'm going to really give the talk about a kind of a flurry of papers that have come out in the last year or year and a half. And that's really as a result of two things. One is the Chandra XVP program that Sarah just spoke about, and the other is the discovery of the galactic center pulsar about a year and a half ago, which has proved to be an outstanding tool for understanding the radio wave propagation through the interstellar medium. And you see many of the people who've contributed to this, and Sarah, Heino Falke, Michael Kramer and his group, Adam Deller in particular on some of the pulsar-related things. So the basic picture that we're addressing here is that the scattering inhibits the imaging, and the simple cartoon is that we have some beautiful radio source over here, Sagittarius A star, produces nice plane parallel waves, and then somewhere along the way it encounters turbulent electron density fluctuations which distort the wavefront, and it distorts it so strongly that we get this resolved elliptical Gaussian that we all know and love with a size that scales as wavelength. And the model that we've been working with until the past year really has been that most of this scattering occurs in the central regions of the galactic center, and part of what I think we can show now is that at least a substantial amount of that scattering is occurring at much greater distances. So this is an idea that we've internalized that the size of Sagittarius A star is a resolved elliptical Gaussian, it scales as wavelength. But I think it's sort of staggering to think about this, that if you saw any other source on the sky whose size scaled as wavelength squared, I think you'd truly be astounded, right? So at 20 centimeters, Sagittarius A star is a half an arc second across, and at 1 millimeter, it's 50 micro arc seconds across. It's really staggering the degree of change in the size, and that's all due to the scattering, or primarily due to the scattering. Now, how do we go about measuring the size? So, when I did my thesis on this a long time ago, this is how we did it, and you measured visibilities as a function of UV distance, and you know, look at what the APJ was willing to publish so long ago. But in fact, if you average things together, you measure a Gaussian, and you're able to constrain the size. But in fact, this technique has its limitations, and as Andrea mentioned, understanding your systematic errors is what's really critical to being able to do science at high precision. And so now we use closure amplitudes, which are immune to many of the systematic errors that contribute to those kind of imaging or even visibility analysis techniques. So this is from our most recent paper, and we're measuring the angular size to an accuracy of better than 1%, getting errors on the order of 3 micro arc seconds in the major axis size. So when we do this at these long wavelengths, we're able to deconvolve the effect of scatter broadening from the intrinsic size because we know the properties of the scatter broadening so well, and in fact, so we're able to measure the intrinsic size of Sagittarius A star over a very long wavelength range, all the way down to a few centimeters, where of course the error bars get quite large, but really we see a size that scales as something like wavelength or wavelength to the 1.5 power. There's a significant amount of uncertainty down at this end, but it's fairly clear that we're seeing the size increase. And as we get down to 7 millimeters, 3 millimeters, we're getting down to 10 Schwarzschild radii in size. Now, here's the story of my failed attempt, Sarah, to look for flaring or changes in the source size as a function of time. So in 2012, as part of the XVP program, we had a triggered response to near-infrared flares detected with Keck and the VLT. And in fact, on one flare, we were able to detect it with a VLT. We were able to get onto the VLBA within an hour of the detection of that flare and do imaging of the black hole. And not only were these periods of activity in the near-infrared, they were at periods of activity in the X-ray. This is a new star flare that that occurred simultaneously with one of our VLBA observations. Significant flaring in this July 21 epoch here. The end result of this is that we see zero or no fluctuation in the size of Sagittarius A star. So this is a rather complicated plot, but it's plotting the intrinsic size of Sagittarius A star, about 35 Schwarzschild radii at a wavelength of 7 millimeters. And for our three epochs where we were triggered by the near-infrared, the time delay after the near-infrared flare peak, so here's the one where we got on within an hour, the Keck flares, we had to wait for the Earth to rotate, very frustrating, but one of those, the red one, also overlapped with the X-ray flare. Nothing happened. At most, a 15% change, but statistically nothing happened in this data, and they're fully consistent with epochs in which there was no pre-detected variability. So this is really consistent with the tail wagging the dog kind of picture for the physics of Sagittarius A star, where we're seeing high energy electrons being excited through some process around near the black hole, but they're not actually energetically important. They're not affecting the energy budget near the peak of the emission, and so it's not changing the size of the radio source. Now, the surprising thing that came out of this, and that came from our ability to measure at high precision the size of Sagittarius A star, is that by combining all of our data together, we're actually able to measure the two-dimensional intrinsic size. Now, over the years, the size of Sagittarius A star has primarily been measured in one dimension, in the major axis dimension, where we have our best angular resolution. But we're able to show that Sagittarius A star is clearly not circular, and the preferred axial ratio is about 3 to 1, but with fairly substantial uncertainty on that. It could be as much as 100 to 1, or it could be as little as 1.5 to 1. The other thing is but the thing that comes with it that we get that is most critical is that we measure the orientation of the ellipticity, and so we get an angle of about 95 degrees on the sky. So that 95 degrees is interesting. So here's our ellipse, very exaggerated in angular size, plotted on a radio image of Sagittarius A star and Sagittarius A west. It's a very nice paper by Mark Morris, Fred Baganoff, and collaborators, suggesting the existence of a jet in this direction, apparent both in the X-ray and maybe in shock structures in the arm. We're not aligned with that. We're misaligned by about 20 degrees. Maybe that can be explained. Maybe it can't. And then the other, I think, surprising result is that orientation is really bang on with the orientation that is seen in the extended Chandra emission on angular scales of about an arc second. Now, this is interesting, but it also, if what we're seeing is an accretion flow or the orientation of the accretion flow in Sagittarius A star, we're essentially seeing that orientation and ellipticity is consistent over four orders of magnitude in radius from the black hole, and that's quite striking. I don't think we can say one way or the other which of these is responsible for it, but I think it's quite interesting. Okay, so let's turn a bit to scattering. So a really remarkable event occurred in our pursuit of G2. A year and a half ago, April of 2013, and the SWIFT satellite was staring at Sagittarius A star, and all of a sudden the light curve went bang, and we all rushed off and said, "Ah, G2 has finally been ripped apart, and interesting things are happening." And of course, something even more interesting than that had taken place, which is discovery of this magnetar here seen by Chandra, and localized just 3 arc seconds or 2 arc seconds away from Sagittarius A star, and that's a tenth of a parsec at that distance, so very, very close. Once pulsations were discovered by New Star, we rushed out to the radio telescopes and discovered, in fact, that it's a was a radio pulsar as well as an X-ray source. I'd love to spend lots of time talking about all the cool intrinsic things you can learn about this object, but I don't have time to do that. But it's an extreme object in many, many different ways and is telling us all sorts of interesting things about the galactic center. This is a really cool image. This is from Farhad. Here's Sagittarius A star, and here's the magnetar, 2.3 arc seconds away. So this is important because it was the discovery that the magnetar was bright all the way up to, in fact, 40 gigahertz. But really neat to see it actually in the image domain here. There it is, blown up a little better. So the source is very faint. It's about a millijansky, but we've been pursuing it with the VLBA, and we've been imaging it. And when you make an image of it, lo and behold, it is a resolved elliptical Gaussian with an orientation of about 80 degrees east-west, exactly the same as Sagittarius A star. So in fact, if you carry out those measurements over a range of wavelengths from 3 centimeters all the way down to 0.7 centimeters, you see that the major axis and the minor axis are fully consistent with the scattering law that we've derived for Sagittarius A star. Now, at the same time, and this is why this is such an incredible measurement or incredible object, Laura Spittler and collaborators measured the temporal broadening of the pulsar. It follows a new to the fourth curve, exactly as you expect from theory. And if you put this together and you say, what will a single thin scattering screen produce? The answer is that it requires that the scattering screen has to exist at a distance of kiloparsecs away from Sagittarius A star. So these are all the different temporal broadening measurements at different frequencies, and the solid curves are the allowed distances for the single scattering screen. This is a purely geometrical model that the temporal broadening comes from the excess path length that's associated with where the location of the angular screen is. So that 6 kiloparsecs that we get, it's actually an interesting distance. It places a scattering screen inside a spiral arm on the way from the galactic center to us out here. There are other solutions to this data. The other simple solution is a distribution of continuous screens, and that also fits our data reasonably well. But in either case, it requires that scattering occur at the angular broadening, in particular, occurs at distances of kiloparsecs from Sagittarius A star. There's a new, very preliminary result that supports this. Olaf Vuknitz used this is just a single baseline measurement, but it's a measurement of the angular broadening as a function of pulse phase. So the theory here, right, is that at the spike of the pulse, you're getting the emission that goes right through the center of the scattering, and that the exponential tail of the scattering comes from the outer wings of the scattering regime. And so what you see in these red dots, I think I'm losing laser power here. Well, there we go. Is that the angular size increases as you go to later and later times in the pulse profile. And this is a very simple model that he's fit and gets a single screen with a distance of about 4 kiloparsecs. This is preliminary, more analysis to come on this, but I think it supports the basic picture. Now, I think this result is somewhat controversial. Not everyone agrees with this interpretation, but I think there are, it's reasonable to posit this. So Sagittarius A star, the scattering we see toward it is not unique. There are other regions in the galaxy that have similar levels of scattering. And the angular scales of about 50 parsec are reasonable. Part of the argument for a close-in scattering region has been missing extragalactic background sources, but new low-frequency surveys seem to suggest that those sources may not, in fact, be missing. And then there's a question of the OH Maser scattering, which appears peaked around Sagittarius A star, but in fact there's really substantial scattering out to tens of degrees from Sagittarius A star. Maybe not quite as strong as what you see towards Sag A star, but quite substantial. So I think the idea that it's coming from a large distance is fairly credible. I'm going to see if this is a working one. It is. Okay. So the other really exciting result that just came out this fall is from Carl Gwynn and his collaborators, in which they looked at Sag A star with high sensitivity and at very long baselines. They see excess flux. So that elliptical Gaussian in the visibility domain, right, the flux should disappear at these long wavelengths, and it doesn't disappear. You get statistically significant detections of the source at long baselines. This is really fascinating. It turns out that this is a direct prediction from Narayan and Goodman, essentially that the image is not fully averaged, and so you get some residual structure associated with this. We can confirm in our data that's present, and as of Friday, I now think it has a frequency-dependent amplitude, so that as you go to shorter wavelengths, higher frequencies, you see a greater effect. That's presumably due to the shrinking size of the source relative to the size of scattering scintils. Let me skip over that. And one more thing, which is that the other thing that the pulsar provides for an understanding Sagittarius A star is that it is a point-like reference source directly adjacent to Sagittarius A star. And so one of the things we're able to do is to measure the frequency-dependent shift in the position of Sagittarius A star relative to the pulsar. So the red circle, the red dot is our average value, consistent with zero, also consistent with models that Monika Moskowska has produced. A jet, you necessarily expect some sort of core shift, an optically thick jet, whereas some kind of concentric accretion system, you don't necessarily expect that. There we go. I've said all that, and I'll just leave that up there. Along with what Andrea said, if you look at G2 in the radio, nothing has happened. Thank you.
Law of information. Any questions? Okay, Eduardo.
Hi. Well, for your hypothesis of the scattering screens midway, can you test that with another quasars or compact objects? Because by probability, you should check that in other directions in the galactic plane.
So we have a VOBA program to look at some of the other pulsars that are in the central half a degree and measure their angular broadening and see if we get we get the same relationship. They actually it's striking. So those other pulsars are at tens of arc minutes from Sag A star, but they actually have a very similar temporal broadening. As we see for the GC pulsar. So I fully anticipate that we're going to get a similar result from them.
Okay. Shep.
I think Eduardo basically asked my question, but I was wondering if you can tell something else from scintillations, you know, on between the single screen and the multiple screens that you showed. There has to be some statistical way of looking at time series to figure out if you're seeing scintillations.
I think the experiment that Olaf Vuknitz is doing is a really interesting test of single screen versus thick screen versus multiple screen approaches, right? Because you're seeing the evolution of the scattering as a function of pulse phase there. And I think that's going to be really powerful for discriminating between those different methods or those different models.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jeff, for your